Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the board meeting of the Air Pollution Control District of San Luis Obispo County for September 17th, 2025. I'm Jan Marks, and I'm the chair this year. I'd like to start out with the flag salute and ask Bruce Gibson, please, to lead us. Thank you. So may we have the roll call, please?
Director Darius.
Here.
Director Eccles.
Here.
Director Gibson.
Here.
Director Hammond.
Here.
Director Marks.
Here.
Director Moreno is not here. Director Newton.
Here.
Director Ortiz Legg is not here. Director Paulding.
Here.
Director Pichon is absent. Director Robert is absent. And Director Seacrest is absent.
So do we have a quorum? All righty. Thank you. Well, we're going to be starting off this morning with a closed session. So let's just, here comes Director Seacrest. Hi. Okay, at 9:02. So let's just clear everyone out who's not on the board except for.
Chairperson Marks, before we adjourn into closed session, let's take public comment on closed session and then ask District Council to adjourn us.
Sorry, yes. Is there any public comment on closed session? Designated labor representatives pursuant to the Government Code, Section 549.57.6, concerning APCD staff compensation and benefits. Seeing none?
Seeing no public comment, let's adjourn to closed session pursuant to Government Code, Section 549.57.6.
All right, thank you. And if the tape can stop running, that'd be great, and we're not going to use microphones, so. Oh, good. Okay, welcome back, everyone. I'd like to ask our council to tell us if there's anything to report out from the closed session.
No reportable action.
Okay, thank you very much. Now we're going to go on to the consent agenda, and I'd like to call for public comment on anything that's listed in the consent agenda. The minutes, the report on the financial status of the district, request to approve adjustments to employee compensation, update on public outreach, request to adjust grant appropriations, amendment to the Air Pollution Control District conflict, request to accept EPA Section 103 one-time grant funds, request to approve Year 8 Community Air Protection Incentive Program, and request to approve updates to the APCD County Human Resources Services contract. So I don't see any public comment. Are there any items that board members would wish to pull or comment on?
I'll move approval of consent.
All right, it's been moved by Director Gibson.
A second.
It's been seconded by Director Seacrest. Do we need a roll call? Okay, roll call, please.
The motion is to approve the consent agenda, items A1 through A9 as proposed. Director Darius.
Yes.
Director Eccles.
Yes.
Director Gibson.
Yes.
Director Hammond.
Aye.
Director Marks.
Yes.
Director Newton.
Yes.
Director Paulding.
Yes.
Director Robert is still absent. Director Seacrest?
Yes.
Motion passes unanimously.
Okay, thank you. And now we're going to ask if there's any public comment for anything that's not on our agenda, not on today's agenda. Do we have any requests for public comment or anyone submitting by email?
No, we do not.
All right, thank you. So let's go on to the APCO's report.
All right, good morning. Thank you, Ms. Marks. So I'll start off with some staffing changes. This is my first meeting officially as the Air Pollution Control Officer. Gary retired August 2nd, and I officially began on the 3rd. Gary is now headed to Hawaii in the next couple days, so getting off to a good start with his retirement. With Gary gone, we are down to 19 full-time equivalents. It is in the budget to hire somebody back and bring us back to 20. At the moment, we're going to wait and see on that. I anticipate we probably will fill a position eventually, but for now, we're waiting and seeing. I have, when I became APCO, I emailed the board and kind of invited everyone to meet with me. As I said in that email, I'd love to meet individually with people, get to know you a little bit better, hear about your any concerns you might have, any priorities, answer any questions. I've met with 6 board members to date, and love to meet with the other 6 if you guys are amenable. So just wanted to remind you of that. Some other staffing changes. Tamara Kaizuka, our fiscal and admin services manager, is retiring at the end of the year. We are we're very sad to see her go. She's done a really great job keeping the ship afloat and getting us, you know, where we need to be financially. We have hired her replacement, who just started this week, Kelly Burns. We're excited to have Kelly. She comes to us from the county, where she's been for 18 years, most recently as a department administrator in the health agency. So sorry to see Tamara go, but really excited to have Kelly here, and they're going to have some good overlap. So I think we're going to have a really good transition there. So not to be outdone, though, the county has stolen away from us our systems administrator. So Jason's been with us for 2.5 years and really done amazing work in those 2.5 years, really revolutionized a lot of our internal systems. So we are sad to see him go. The county got a great hire there. We currently have a systems admin 3 recruitment that is open, closes on September 29th. So if anyone knows anyone who might be interested, please send them our way. Couple other notes. So Megan is clerking today, Megan Field. Getting a little practice, you know, just she's our backup. So we want to make sure she, you know, gets some good practice while Alyssa's here. And then finally, we do have one staff member who just started maternity leave. We expect her to be back in January. But so we're a little bit short-staffed as a result of that. So shifting gears, I became APCO on August 3rd, which is about the same time that the Gifford fire broke out. As I'm sure you all know, this was a major fire. It was the largest fire in California for the 2025 season, with 131 acres burned. It's actually still active. Between the Gifford fire and the Madre fire, which happened right next door to it, about 330 square miles burned, which is about 10% of the land area of the county. So this fire started on 166 on the south side of the county and burned kind of northwest through National Forest, headed towards Santa Margarita. So the lucky for us for the air district, or from the perspective of air quality, we had pretty good meteorology, favorable meteorology from an air quality perspective, which conversely is bad from a firefighting perspective. But we had high mixing heights and good dispersion, so the smoke mostly went up. And then we had winds out of the northwest, so it pushed the winds out of our county into Santa Barbara and elsewhere. So impacts were pretty minimal. There was, you know, obviously right in the evacuation zone, it was quite smoky. And then there were several days in the Carrizo Plain, California Valley area, where we had air quality indices in the unhealthy range. But outside of those areas, very minimal impacts. We had a couple days in North County with some very moderate impacts, but for the most part, we really dodged a bullet in terms of air quality. So that's good. Our role when it comes to these wildfires, you know, the Air District, we're not first responders. Our role is really forecasting air quality, monitoring air quality, and then a lot of outreach and public information. And I'm really proud of our staff and how we did with that. So we were doing daily detailed air quality forecasts and pushing those out over social media, through our website, through press releases. Our monitoring staff hustled and got two additional regulatory grade smoke monitors out there, one on the Carrizo Plain and one on Lake Lopez. And then also a couple of low cost sensors, one at the Park Hill Fire Department and another at a residence kind of deep in Wasna Valley. And that really helped us track the impacts of the smoke. We issued three press releases in coordination with the County Health Agency and the emergency offices, the EOC. And one of those included school recommendations. This was all happening, of course, right before school was supposed to restart. And so we did a press release that has our recommendations for, you know, if the air quality index gets this high, this is what we recommend you do with your students, that type of stuff. As I mentioned, daily social media posts. Cody Gibbons and I separately were on KCBX, and then I was on KSBY one night. So anyways, I really want to recognize Megan as our public information officer for all the hard work she did. And then Cody Gibbons and David Cardiel as our monitoring team. They really hustled and got some good data for us. And Cody's also our main forecaster. He did a great job with all that. So a little bit of a grants update. So later on today, Megan's going to present our grant report. So she's going to talk about all the money that we got out the door and into people's hands in fiscal year 2024-25. I'm going to talk right now about the coming year. So since you approved our budget in June, we received two grant awards from CARB. So these were not included in that budget. One is the Community Air Protection Incentive Program. So this was just approved, you just approved the budget adjustment associated with this one today. That was item A8 on consent. That's a little more than $700,000 in total, which is going to go towards EV charging infrastructure and ag engine replacement or off-road engine replacement. That one, 80% of the money needs to be spent in low-income communities. And then the other one that we just got word of at the end of August is the Carl Moyer program. So we were awarded $561,000 for that. And that's going to go towards ag equipment replacement. And we intend to bring a budget adjustment to you in January for those monies. Farmer is still not funded, and we don't expect to see that funded this year. And I will say, looking at our budget, in the June budget that you approved talks about taking about $200,000 out of reserves to cover a budget gap. With this grant money coming in and some other changes that have happened since then, now it's looking like at the end of the day, we will put more money into reserves this fiscal year than we take out. That, of course, is a projection. It's still very early in the fiscal year, but that's good news. Also on grants, so in general, we continue to look for opportunities to, for efficiencies, streamline, how can we do things better, smarter. And so with regard to the grants, last year, for the first time, we had our first online grant application. That was a very simple one. That was for our Clean Air Rooms program, where we were giving away air filters to people who meet certain income requirements. They basically just had to go online, their name, address, upload some documents that prove their eligibility, and they were good to go. Now, going live in the next few days is going to be our application for our EV infrastructure program. This is much more complicated. So from a technological standpoint, this is a big leap forward, and we're really excited about it. And this is going to allow folks to apply online rather than mailing or bringing in their forms. It's also going to really help ensure that we get complete packages from the applicants, because it's all going to be right there. Like, you need X, Y, and Z, and it won't let you proceed unless you have that. So it's going to help our applicants understand what they need to have a complete application. It's going to streamline our process for intake and for review of these. And ultimately, it's going to get people in line for grant money more quickly. So we're excited about that. And then lastly, on the grants front, we had a visit from CARB last month. So their division chief and the assistant division chief for their mobile source division came by, and also some other folks, including the chief of their incentives branch. So these are the folks that really run these grant programs at CARB. It was a great meeting, obviously good networking, good to put faces to names, but you know, we were able to provide some frank feedback to CARB about how to improve these programs, because there's a lot of, you know, a lot of hoops to jump through for us to take the money and to, you know, dot all the I's and cross all the T's that we need to do to get the money out. And of course, that rolls down onto the applicants and what we require of them. And a lot of this information is maybe ultimately not that useful. So anyways, we were able to provide some frank feedback on how to make the program better and basically, you know, get the money out the door and into people's hands faster to realize these emission reductions. So that was well received. It was a good meeting. I expect that, you know, we'll see some good changes coming out of it. Briefly, legislative update. Everything is, this is a good news update. So I talked last time, I talked about AB 471. This is about air district compensation, and for boards like this, for board members to be able to receive modest stipends for attending board meetings. So that was our state Senator Laird eventually signed on as a co-author, and this passed the Assembly and Senate with bipartisan support and is now on the governor's desk waiting for his signature. So if that item is signed, then with a resolution, the board would be able to resume paying stipends. And then if we do that, we need to submit a report to the legislature in 3 years just on, you know, what effect has that had on board member attendance and stuff like that. So the other one, and I'm wearing my my whale tie in honor of this, was AB 14. So AB 14, this is the Blue Whales, Blue Skies program. You've heard about this before. This is voluntary vessel speed reduction program, which currently exists kind of as a patchwork up and down the coast. But if these big shipping companies slow down to 10 knots, that has a tremendous impact on air quality, really reduces NOx emissions and also greenhouse gas emissions, and has a huge impact on survivability for whale strikes. So it's a win-win for air quality and for whales. And the program is completely voluntary. It is completely, there's no money associated with it. Basically, they get a kudos. They get to, it's kind of like Dolphin Safe Tuna. They get to say like they're participating for it, and it's good PR for them. So they love it. And this bill, AB 14, makes it a statewide program all up and down the coast. And so that passed that Assembly and Senate and is now also on the governor's desk. So that's great news. Governor has until October 12th to act on these and everything else that just passed through the legislature. And then, so lastly, or not almost lastly, I'll talk about the Oceano Dunes. So this is the time of year when things get a little bit, there's a lot of activity on our end with the dunes. So according to the stipulated order of abatement, the State Parks' annual report and work plan is due annually on August 1st. This is the plan where they talk about how they did last year over the previous 12 months, and they give us the plan for what they want to do for the next 12 months. So this year they asked for an extension of the deadline, which we granted to August 15th. We provided our feedback, and their next draft is due on September 29th. So currently there are 740 acres within the Oceano Dunes that's being managed for dust control, or being managed in a way that provides a dust control benefit. The modeling that they submitted with this most recent annual report and work plan demonstrates that they have met the emission reduction goal of the SOA, and in fact suggests that they can roll back some of the mitigations that are in place and reopen some of the area to riding. We do have some concerns about the assumptions that underlie that modeling. So in our comment letter, we basically said, hold on, pump the brakes, let's go back and check some of these assumptions and redo some of the modeling. And so we're waiting for that. We'll see what that looks like. So at also related, also going on at the June hearing board meeting, which happened right after our last board meeting, we presented them a new measurement-based metric for determining or tracking compliance with the stipulated order of abatement. This is the so-called SAG metric. And that June meeting was informational only, but the proposed metric was received very favorably. And they asked us to come back at the next hearing board meeting and put it on the agenda to incorporate it into the hearing, into the stipulated order, and make it an enforceable part of the order. So we're working with State Parks on what that would look like. This is a stipulated order. So we have, you know, us and State Parks, we need to come to an agreement on any modification to the order. So we're working with State Parks on what that might look like. Next hearing board meeting is October 15th, where they will, we'll talk about that potential modification to the order and also present to them what by that point will be the second draft, the final annual report and work plan. I'll also mention that the hearing board, we will be opening a recruitment for a public and a medical member in October. So if you know anyone who might be interested, you can send them our way. The public member doesn't have to have any qualifications. The medical member needs to be in the medical field, does not necessarily need to be a doctor, but our current member is. So, but he is leaving the hearing board. So if you know anyone who might be interested, you can send them our way. And then lastly, is with regard to the dunes, how are we doing this year? So back in June, you guys received and filed our annual air quality report. And as you might remember, it was a great year for air quality on the Mesa. We had big improvements. I mean, it was still elevated relative to the rest of the county, but we had the fewest number of exceedances of the state standard on the Mesa, the fewest number of Rule 1001 exceedances on the Mesa. Other metrics that we talked about all looked really good and were either at their lowest level or very close to it. So that was good news. This year, year to date, it has been windier than last year, year to date. So we do see more exceedances now than we did by this point last year. So right now we've had unofficially 24 exceedances at CDF versus 12 last year. And Rule 1001 exceedances, we've had 15 in 2025 so far versus 9 by this point last year. Again, it's been windier so far, so I'm not too excited about this uptick in exceedances. It's still much lower than we used to see. And once we have the full year under our belt, we can run all our statistics and some of the more sophisticated stuff and see how we turned out. So lastly, and this really is the end, two unrelated items. Walk to School Day is coming. That's Wednesday, October 8th. We do this every year. It's a fun event. We partner with a couple local schools and we hand out information and prizes and do games with the kids who walk to school. So that's coming up. We're excited about that. And then lastly, iRideShare, which is SlowCog's program to incentivize alternative commutes. Every summer they run a clean air challenge where they challenge participating employers to put teams together to see how many trips they can reduce. And for this challenge, alternative commutes by you know, commutes to work, also work trips and personal trips, all of that count. You can put together a team of 10 people and track all your commutes and, you know, any type of alternative transportation other than working from home or, you know, other than telecommuting counts. So this year, for the second year in the row, the Clean Air Heads, that's our APCD team, we won that. The DA's office came in second. So all the members of our team will get to choose either a free annual pass to the national parks or the free annual pass to the state parks, the California Explorer pass. So we're excited about that. We logged 601 trips. We saved an estimated 4.3 tons in carbon dioxide and saved an estimated $4,400 in vehicle operation money. So anyways, that's my That's my report. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Just a quick comment. Thank you. I thought the commentary on State Park's proposal was very thoughtfully written. Appreciate both SAG and district staff weighing in, and be interested to see how the SAG metric gets implemented. It's metrics are an attempt to reduce complex systems into simple numbers, and I get the inclination to do it. I hope that it helps bring some clarity to the enforcement of the SOA.
Thank you for your report. Two questions on two separate items. The first is just out of curiosity. You mentioned 740 acres of the dunes are under monitoring. Do you know out of the total acreage what that is, or what the total acreage is over there? I'm just thinking in my mind what percentage we're monitoring.
Yeah, so the whole Oceano Dunes district, I think it's about 3,000 acres, but only about 1,500 acres has historically been available for riding and camping. And of that 1,500 acres, 300 acres is the so-called plover exclosure, which seasonally would be closed. So it would be closed for 7 months of the year for habitat protection, and then opened for the other 5 months of the year. So really about 1,200 acres that were open year-round.
Great, thank you. So about 60% or so. The second question that I have for you, I represent Morro Bay as a city council member, and we sent the city sent a letter to CARB regarding the diesel engine restrictions. Mm-hmm. And the letter that the city sent was asking for an extension on a cutoff date,
right,
so that folks out there would still be able to apply for grants to have those diesels switched out. For Morro Bay, it's extremely important because we have lots of operators there that will be put out of business if they're not able to access a grant. The city, I'm under the impression that the city sent a CC to the APCD of that letter, and I was hoping that the APCD could forward that letter to CARB as well on behalf of the APCD.
We certainly could. Was this recently sent, or this was?
So it should have been sent a week or two ago. I haven't received an email back, and I forgot about this until this morning, so I apologize for that. It should have been sent a couple of weeks ago, because it was sent to CARB a couple of weeks ago. So if you haven't received it yet, I'll be sure that you receive it today.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing it. I don't think it's come in.
Unknown caller.
But yeah, we can touch base and make sure that we get it, and then we can make sure that it goes to that it gets to CARB.
Very good. Thank you.
Unknown caller.
Does unknown caller have a question? Just kidding. I have a question about the stipends.
Yes.
It was sort of confusing. At some point, the APCD decided that that board members were employees and had to fill out all these forms and everything. And every other regional board does not consider board members to be employees. And then the stipends stopped altogether. That in order to get the stipends earlier, we had to categorize ourselves as employees. So I'm just curious, that's my first question about the stipends. And the second thing is about the dollar amount. Do we also have to set the dollar amount, or is that statutorily regulated?
Yeah, so take your second question first. So the dollar amount, it's up to $200 per meeting plus reasonable expenses. So you would have the freedom to set a lower dollar amount if you want. But $200 is the limit. And then we did pay stipends for the city council members, but we stopped that because previous year, the large multi-county districts got the same bill passed, and that highlighted the fact that we weren't on firm legal ground for paying the stipends in the first place. So that's why the stipends have gone away. It's not because of this employee issue. But there is, we did make a change at some point to considering board members as employees and having to onboard them and go through that process in order to pay the stipends when we had the stipends. And I will ask Tamara to comment on that.
Good morning. Tamara Kaizuka, Fiscal and Admin Division Manager. Some of you may remember about 2.5 years ago, we went through a Section 218 correction process. And during that process, it was brought to our attention that if we were paying stipends to board members, that those stipends are subject to part of the payroll taxes. In order then to deduct the payroll taxes, we had to have them put into the payroll system. We use the county's payroll services, and so that means that we have to then onboard the directors into the payroll system in order to correctly withhold the payroll taxes. Does that help?
Well, it helps, but I don't know for any of our SLOCOG or RTA members, is that handled the same way it wasn't when I was on SLOCOG for, or RTA for, 8 years, I think. So I'm just curious.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I think the net result was that was unduly burdensome. So that was one of part of the reason that the stipends went away, so that we would not have to go through that whole process. This bill now gives us the path forward to do it without that burden, I assume.
The administrative burden would still be present.
Would be present, okay.
It does not change the character of the stipends. They are still subject to basic payroll
taxes. Really? So you bring up a good question. I mean, as a supervisor, never had to deal with it because we're so lavishly compensated in our day job. But I guess that is not the norm, as I understand it, in the other regional agencies. And is that a determination APCD legal counsel has made, or is that
this came to us from
CalAFCO,
the state, or? And the state Social Security
really?
Administrator's office
really?
As well.
Really? Oh boy.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, Kate.
So speaking as another lavishly compensated this time for Aurora Grande City Council, I can just say, you know, speaking for myself, I appreciate the stipend, but I was almost to the point of like, you know what, go ahead and keep that stipend for the amount of annoyance it caused, honestly. So it would be great if we didn't have to go through all that.
Yeah, I would just like to ask perhaps our council and also our financial folks to just take another run at it and see if we really, because also I consider it volunteer work, you know, essentially. Yeah. So anyway, any other questions? Continuing down this way, Mr. Hammond.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Carl, great report. I appreciate it. One thing I wanted to kind of get into maybe is another 10,000 foot view of the Carl Moyer program. It's been a long time. I think Andy used to do that a lot. And is there a way that maybe we can get an overview of what Carl Moyer is and how my question is getting to is how restrictive is it and who can we distribute those funds to? So can we kind of get a little quick synopsis of what the program is?
Yeah, well, we're going to have actually our next item on the agenda is our grant report for the last fiscal year. So we're going to go into a little bit of that. And so maybe if that doesn't answer your question, then we can answer. Sure. You can ask it then.
That'd be good. Thank
okay.
you.
Great, okay, it looks like there are no more questions. I'd like to know if there's any public comment on the APCO report. Seeing none, did we get any public comment? No. Okay,
no.
Thank you very much. So now we're gonna go on to board business, item B1, and I'm gonna call for public comment if there is any on that item. Report on emissions reduction projects funded through the APCD grant programs.
Chairperson Marks, we should probably call for public comment after the report.
Oh, okay. Alrighty. During the fiscal year 2024-2025, this is a receive and file item.
All right, good morning, everyone. My name is Megan Field. As Carl mentioned, I am our public information officer and I'm an air quality specialist at the agency. And I do several of our grant programs. I work on farmer. I've done marine in the past, agricultural equipment, you know, replacement program, our wood smoke changeout, clean air rooms, and most recently our lawn and garden electrifications. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about our program this previous fiscal year, what we've been able to fund, and the outreach efforts that we've made to make sure everybody knows about all of our programs. Okay. So a little bit of background on our program. The APCD has been administering our grant programs since 1997. So we're in our 28th year of grant program administration. And in those 28 years of grant programs, we've been able to award $40.6 million. We're excited to hit over that $40 million mark this year and realized over 3,400 tons of emission reductions. To give you a little bit of perspective on how much that actually is, that's the equivalent to removing 3.5 years of all vehicle emissions in Slo County. So that would be no vehicles operating on Slo County roads for 3.5 years. That's how much emission reductions we've been able to realize. Historically, the largest funding sources have been our local DMV funds. These are registration fees that are paid to DMV and set aside for emission reduction projects. We have our Carl Moyer funds. These are funds received from smog checks and tire disposal fees. And then we have our local mitigation funds. These are typically emission offsets for large-scale construction projects. And then we have the state's CAP and Invest program. This funds multiple programs, including our community air protection program, farmer, and our past and future wood smoke reduction program. So overall, this $40 million represents the over $1.4 million in funds that were authorized by your board in the previous fiscal year, and approximately $128,000 in admin funds over that same period. So this slide shows a list of the available grant programs that we currently offer. We have our off-road agriculture and construction equipment replacement programs, stationary ag engine electrification, EV charging, school bus replacement, and moving forward, we're focusing only on electric school bus replacements. We continue to have our wood smoke reduction program, and we have a little bit of funding left for our lawn and garden electrification program. So shifting from allocations to expenditures that we had in the previous fiscal year, this fiscal year we had over $2.6 million in projects that we were able to fund. The largest share were almost equally from our Carl Moyer, DMV, and farmer programs, really providing the lion's share to local businesses, school districts, and agencies to provide funding for everything from those agricultural tractors to the in-home air purifiers. I'll talk a little bit more about each of those categories in a minute. The total emission reductions this fiscal year from all these projects was estimated at 59.4 tons. Over the life of their contracted periods. And however, total emission reductions will actually be much greater since their new low emission equipment operates well past their contracted lives. So the first program I'll talk about is our off-road equipment replacement program. This replaces old ag tractors and construction equipment with the newest, cleanest available. This photo that I have here is of a 1968 tractor that we replaced this previous fiscal year, and this project alone provides over 2.3 tons of weighted emission reductions over the life of their three-year contract. So our program covers replacement of tractors, like-for-like tractors that do equivalent work. And so here is the new tractor that you can see that replaced that 1968 tractor. It looks much larger, but it's actually a like-for-like replacement to that 1968 model. It's only about 13 horsepower more, and even though it's slightly larger, this tractor is overall 25% more fuel efficient. And as you can see, they opted for an added cab for driver safety and comfort. Those types of upgrades are actually not included in our program. The applicant pays for those on their own. In the previous fiscal year, we had over $1.2 million that went to local agriculturalists to replace 16 of those ag tractors. So that's right in the hands of our local farmers and homeowners too. We had a couple of local farmers that applied that didn't have big operations. If you remember, this past fiscal year, our program was only open for the first 6 months for small businesses. And so that funding was taken up immediately by small businesses. So we worked with a lot of new farmers that we had never worked with before, which was really encouraging. All right, now we have our school bus replacement program. In the past fiscal year, we spent over $392,000 to complete two new bus replacements. These two buses were natural gas, but as I mentioned, moving forward, we're going to be doing electric replacements. And looking ahead to this next year, we're working with multiple school districts right now on school bus replacements. Historically, we've funded maybe two buses a year with all of our grant funding. But this year, part of a record, we're going to be doing 18 electrifications of school buses. So school districts are really ramping up their utilization of those electric school buses to transport kiddos. All right, next we have our lawn and garden electrification program. We spent over $139,000 to replace 86 pieces of lawn and garden equipment. So those pieces of equipment ranged from chainsaws to big ride-on lawn mowers. We have about $20,000 remaining in this program right now. We have our wood smoke change out program, our wood smoke reduction program, and we spent just over $36,000 to change out seven wood stoves or fireplaces to a cleaner burning technology. There's seven there. We had about five people that went to all electric heat pumps. One went to a cleaner burning wood device, and then we had one natural gas project remaining from some historic funding we had. All right, next is our EV infrastructure program. We installed 33 total charging ports, totaling over $836,000. You can see on the screen there's a picture of some solar. As part of some of these projects, we were able to fund some of the solar that is used to help charge and electrify these charging ports. As an update to a staff presentation that we did back in May regarding a big slow DC fast charger project that we're doing, those site assessments and budget were completed in early September, and site hosts will be taking these projects to their board, and hopefully we'll release an RFP in the next couple of months. So this will be a huge San Luis Obispo County-wide DC fast charger project at multiple sites throughout the county. All right, lastly, we finished up our clean air rooms program this past fiscal year, finishing off the distribution of about 60 air purifiers to low-income individuals. In total, this program provided over 359 air purifiers. In my opinion, I think the best part of this program was that, you know, besides those residents getting clean air devices in their homes, we were able to touch every single community in our county, you know, from San Simeon, to San Miguel and Pozo, Los Osos. It was a great program. All right, so with any successful program, you need some outreach to make sure people know about it. We work very closely with local equipment dealers for our replacement program, as well as our wood smoke reduction program. We also target specific media advertisements through and do direct outreach and participate in community events across the county. We've also been working closely with organizations like the Promotores Collaborative, Diversity Coalition, and working with the Farm Worker Outreach Task Force and SLO County Public Health to ensure everyone in our county, regardless of the language that they speak, is aware of our programs and able to apply. So in the past several years, we've really tried to be more effective in our community engagement, prioritizing people and trying to better understand their needs and priorities in their specific communities so that we know where to dedicate our future grant funding. All right, and looking ahead to next year, the legislature has slated approximately $1.7 million for grant programs in our county. As you can see on the screen, I've listed some of the bigger programs that we have. 28th year of Moyer program, we're getting around $479,000. CAP year 8, which as Carl mentioned earlier, we weren't necessarily expecting that we were going to be getting that, but we are, and so that's about $600,000 that we'll be able to use for projects. We have local DMV funding, which we're expecting to be around $540,000, and then unfortunately right now Farmer continues to not be included in the state budget, but we continue to advocate for that to be included through CARB. All right, so that is my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone has about our grant program.
Yeah, let's again start down this way. Any questions, sir?
I realize a lot of these grants have limited uses that you can use them for, but let's just say in a perfect world they were unrestricted. When you look at emission reductions versus dollars spent, you know, what gives you the greatest return? You know, what category is it? You know, replacing lawn and garden equipment, is it tractor replacement? At the end of the day, what is the best value per dollar spent?
Well, I would say that as far as the money spent by our staff to implement these programs, the programs like the tractor replacement program is hands down one of our easiest and quickest programs to be able to fund and provides a huge emission benefit. When you look at programs like lawn and garden and clean air rooms, they are great programs and offer emission benefits, but as far as how much, we don't totally see that. And so the tractors provide a huge, you know, bang for the buck.
Okay. But we don't track really for a dollar spent, what is the most efficient, correct?
Not necessarily by those means, but for every single project, we have caps that are set for how cost effective a project, like what the maximum limit is. For tractors, for example, it's $60,000 per ton reduced. And so we look at every single project to see what is the cost effectiveness of this project and how much did it cost us. And typically with these, especially with these older tractors, we're seeing them coming in around $20,000 per ton of emissions reduced.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions? Sir.
Yes. Thank you, Megan, for your report. With regard to the school bus spike, and I apologize if I missed it, but can you speak to the attribution, why there was such a tremendous spike, and as well how that's being financed?
Yeah, so I think the school buses, like I mentioned, we've historically done 1, 2, maybe 3 school buses per year. And we're seeing that huge spike go up to 18 in this upcoming year. We've been really proactive with a lot of the different school districts to let them know about, you know, future mandates that are coming down from for turning over their fleets to electric. And honestly, there's been a lot of money right now. The state has additional funding on top of what we're able to offer. And so there's more money available for school districts to go electric. And I think they're seeing kind of the writing on the wall that that's where everybody's moving is electric.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you very much for your report. And the question about how do you quantify the results on the, say, the tractor replacement program. But when you're talking about something like clean air rooms, you're talking about saving children from severe asthma attacks and things of that nature. Is that correct?
Correct.
So is there really a way to quantify
it's
that?
Hard. I mean, it's a very hard thing to quantify. Yeah. So, and we don't necessarily look at, you know, emission reductions with the program like that. So, yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a question about the DMV, the fees that we get from that. There are a lot of electric cars now on the road. Do we get DMV fees for the electric cars, even though they're not creating direct emissions?
Yes, it's something that's on every car registration. When you pay for your registration every year, uh-huh. There's a air quality fee that's on there. For everyone.
Whether it's an EV or
I believe so.
Not.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Sir. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Great report, as always. Mm-hmm. Great work. On the clean air room program, are we reauthorizing that grant program for the
not at this year? Moment, okay. We do have some funding for the Carl Moyer State Reserve program. We're kind of evaluating right now what we're going to be using that funding for. But at this time, we use some standalone funding for the previous program. So we're evaluating it.
Okay.
The program did slow down a lot at the end. So we had a huge spike in the amount of participants, and then it took us a while to get the money back out. So we might wait a little bit before we launch it again.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Hammond.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Megan, again, more on the Carl Moyer thing. Again, the Moyer funds are basically derived from DMV fees.
Completely. Moyer funds are smog check and tire disposal fees.
That's the two sources.
Correct.
In the state.
Yes.
And so our county and our proportional share of what we get from that, has that to do with population or How does the state regulate where that money goes?
So the state, it's a perpetual funding amount that the state has for the Carl Moyer program. And I'm not sure how they do the calculation, but they divide it across all of the districts, all of the air districts in California to administer the program. And some have the option to not take the funding. And so it adjusts how much each district gets. But historically, we've gotten between $400,000 and $500,000 every year for that program.
Yeah, that's what Carl said. So is it restrictive? In other words, when it comes to our hands, how is it, are there ties to how we can use it, or can you explain that?
Sure. So the Carl Moyer program has a set of guidelines that we need to adhere to. And there's multiple chapters that define different projects that we can do. Everything from funding it with EV infrastructure to off-road equipment to lawn and garden. There's numerous categories. And so what we do as part of our outreach is that we are talking to community members about where that need needs to be. And we get calls all the time from the public saying, oh, I'd like this kind of project. I'm interested in this. And so we kind of gauge every year around this time of year, because we bring it to the board in January. We try to see what the community actually needs and what can we actually fund. So we do have some level of restriction in what kind of projects we can fund. But the state is open. If there's something specific that we would like to do in our community that's not part of that, there are options to get case-by-case approvals for special projects.
Okay, very good. That's right. Thank you, Megan.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We have another question here.
Sorry, not to ask a stupid question, but why would a county refuse the funds?
Well, some air districts are not like ours. We are a medium district, and some operate with one staffer that is also the ag commissioner and also runs their airport, for example. So they don't have the capacity. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. So I don't see any further questions at this point.
Great. All right. Thank you very much.
I'm going to call for public comment. Is there any public comment on the report? Seeing none, we'll go on to item B2, performance indicators report for fiscal year 2024-25.
All right. Tupper. Thank you. And thanks, Megan, for that great report. So performance indicators for 2025. This is basically our report card on ourselves. So we set goals, we track our performance against those goals, and we make sure we're on track, and we, you know, adjust course if need be. So we measure our performance on some key programs. Every year we prioritize our operations, and then we track this and revise as needed. So in 2020, so this is for the last fiscal year. So for 2024-25, our key accomplishments are in these categories, and I'll go into detail on all of them, but Oceano Dunes, our grants program, I mean, Megan basically went over all that just now. Transportation and mobile sources, I'll talk about our compliance and engineering programs, and then lastly, outreach. So Oceano Dunes, as I mentioned earlier, we've got about 740 acres providing dust controls. And as we presented back in June in our annual air quality report, compared 2024 compared to before the stipulated order, we see a 39% decrease in PM10 at CDF on windy days, and a lesser reduction at Mesa 2, 10.4%. And as I mentioned, the modeling estimates that the ODSVRA, the Oceano Dunes, is now emitting less dust than it did prior to disturbance by off-road vehicles. So that's the modeling. As I mentioned, there's some details we're still working through there. So whether they actually have met that goal or not, they're definitely close. I feel good about that. This is a graph that you guys saw at the last board meeting of Rule 1001 violations. You can see that 2024 had the fewest ever, a really nice decline over the years. So 2017 and prior was before the stipulated order. And then, you know, with the stipulated order coming into effect in 2018, you can see this nice decline in rule violations. And this parallels other metrics that we track. And as I just talked about in my APCO report for 2025, year to date, we don't look quite as good as last year, but it has been significantly windier. So I think that's what's going on there. Grant programs, Megan just went through this, so I'll just highlight that we got about $2.6 million out the door last year, and that resulted in about 59 tons of criteria emission reductions. So for transportation and mobile sources, there are two things I want to highlight. One is the South Central Coast Cal EVIP program. So this is a program for that spans our county, Santa Barbara, and Ventura. It's in total, it's a $12 million program for EV chargers in the Tri-County area. Last year, last fiscal year for our county, we got 20 DC fast chargers installed at five locations, totaling about $1.7 million. And those locations are the Sea Pines Golf Course in Los Osos, Idlers in Paso, Broad Street House of Breads here in San Luis Obispo, and the Lamplighter Inn and Quality Suites on Monterey Street here in SLO. This other item is the SLOCOG VMT mitigation study. So VMT is vehicle miles traveled. We assisted SLOCOG on this mitigation study. This was funded by Caltrans, and it's to comply with SB 743, which eventually is going to require a 15% reduction in VMT for new development. So we assisted SLOCOG in performing that study. In compliance and engineering, we do a lot. We're inspecting sources, we're responding to complaints, we're issuing permits, we're reviewing asbestos projects, and we're also running a burn program where we issue burn permits for big, you know, everything from massive 9,000 acre prescribed burns down to, you know, backyard burns that people are doing out in the county. So in the last fiscal year, we issued 143 authorities to construct or permit revisions, and that's an increase from 99 the previous fiscal year. We did over 1,300 inspections of facilities, and we renewed over 1,100 permits. Our goal is to do our permit renewals within 45 days of when they are due, and we met that goal for more than 95% of our permit renewals. We reviewed 71 new asbestos projects, and that's up from 59 the previous fiscal year. And we issued 1,875 burn permits, which is about a 10% increase over the previous fiscal year. That's including 1,200 backyard burns, over 600 ag burns, and then a bunch of you know, prescribed burns and similar burns to that. We also responded to 90 complaints last fiscal year, which is down from about 50% down from the previous year where we had 150. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, you know, we're responding to all the complaints we receive, and we're getting fewer complaints, which I think a lot of that is Oceano Dunes. We're not getting as many complaints about the dunes. We also tend to get complaints when there are wildfires, not necessarily about the wildfires, but, you know, people, when there's a big wildfire, people get, you know, they're all of a sudden aware of it. And then when they see a prescribed burn, when they see like a backyard burn or an ag burn, you know, they might call us. Anyways, complaints are down. That's a good thing. And so talking about messaging, so we do a lot of messaging around smoke. We try to get out there ahead of wildfire season and remind people of how they can protect themselves from smoke, where they can find information about air quality. So we did that. We collaborated with public health and other local agencies about smoke when smoke was present. This year, for the first time, we collaborated with some local tribes around cultural burning. So we had the Johnson Ranch cultural burn, and then also a couple burns out in Carrizo Plain that were done in collaboration with the local tribes, and we did a lot of messaging around that. And then we continue to coordinate with Cal Fire and other big land managers like the National Guard and state parks. So, you know, whenever they do their big wildfires, we want to make sure the public is aware, so, you know, so they're not taken by surprise. So we, you know, we continue our public awareness campaigns. We had more than 50 mentions in the media. We issued 11 press releases, almost 3,500 community members are signed up to get AirAware text alerts on their phone. So these are anything from the blowing dust alerts for the Napomo Mesa to general air quality alerts when we have wildfire impacts or high ozone days, things of that nature. And then we continue to utilize social media. We're on Facebook, we're on Nextdoor, we're on X. So over 1,000 posts across those various social media channels in the previous fiscal year. We work with, as Megan mentioned in her presentation, a lot of different local nonprofits to get word out about our grant programs and about how people can protect themselves from air quality, how they can find air quality information. So Diversity Coalition, the Promotores, things like that. We are a sponsor and do a lot of work with National Drive Electric Week and kind of EV events at farmers markets and elsewhere. We continue to sponsor the Slow Blues, which is a great opportunity for us to get our name out there and people to learn about who we are. Also Cal Poly Athletics. This year we did a series of presentations with local boys and girls clubs. And we work with local elementary schools on like Earth Day and things like that, but also bike to school, walk to school day. We continue to do those activities. Agency resiliency and streamlining. This first item is something I'm really proud of with our agency. So we partnered with Cal Fire. So we've always required burn permits for any kind of type of burning in our county. Cal Fire in the last couple of years also is requiring their own burn permit for any burning in the county. So now people, if you want to burn or if you want to burn legally, you've got to have two permits, which, you know, we understand is confusing and burdensome. So we partnered with Cal Fire and made our website the one-stop shop. So you can go to our website and enter your information and simultaneously get our burn permit and Cal Fire's for any type of backyard burning and most ag burns. Bigger burns and special cases are still a little, you know, are different. But for the vast majority of burn permits, we're a one-stop shop. It's easier for the public. It's also easier for us. A lot of what used to be processing things by hand and intaking forms through email or stuff that got dropped off, now it all just happens electronically. So that's a huge innovation for us. Really excited about it, and I really got to hand it to Alyssa Roslin for spearheading that, and then Jason, who of course is leaving us, but Jason Dornich. They did a tremendous amount of work to make that happen. And then we continue to meet our our cost reduction and budgetary goals under the fiscal plan that you all approved previously, and we're going to start working on a new fiscal plan in the next year or so. And then we continue to look for other ways to streamline, how can we do more with less staff? How can we work smarter instead of harder? Things like that. And that is it. Any questions I can answer?
Yeah, any questions down at this end? And no? Already? Nope. Okay. Any down here? All right. Looks like there are no questions. So
great.
We'll call for public comment if any. Anyone in the public wishes to comment? I just want to say I'm really impressed with how well your agency is meeting the goals, and I like the idea of a self report card rather than having anyone else force you to do that. That's great.
Great, thank you.
Okay, so now we'll go on to B3. A spotlight, landfill gas collection systems. All right.
All righty. I'm Sarah Wade. I've been here before, but it's been a bit, so a few new faces. I'm an engineer here at the Air District, and one of our programs that we run is the landfill program. We have a variety of different specific programs like asbestos burn program that are shared with engineering and compliance. This is one of them. Featured here in the middle is Anna. She's actually pretty instrumental to the compliance portion of our program, but she's the one who ditched us on maternity leave, so here I am. But I did want to say that she helped me prepare this presentation, and she's instrumental to everything we do, so couldn't do without her. So why do we care about landfills? Well, as the waste is buried, it generates gas when it's decomposing, and that gas can contain toxic air contaminants, volatile organic compounds, and methane. And with volatile organic compounds, that is an ozone precursor. Ozone helps generate smog, so we want to minimize how much of those are released. And then with methane, it is a more potent greenhouse gas by more than 28 times than carbon monoxide, so it is important that we minimize that as well. And then on top of that, it's odorous gas, so we want to make sure that all this gas is collected and controlled. And when you're at a landfill, that's actually what you'd see, is the top of it is the wells, but what's actually going on underneath is in this diagram, very simplified version, but essentially the wells go down into the landfill between 40 and 140 feet, even deeper if it's in a canyon or a quarry, and they're collecting under vacuum the landfill gas that is generated. So there is a lot going on in a landfill, but on the gas portion, this is throughout the whole landfill. Active portions that are being filled don't quite have this yet, or they may have it in some of the filled areas, but the closed areas for sure have the wells. So on the right is more of like the simplified version of what that well is doing, and then they're all interconnected and sent to a control system. So those control systems can look like this. The most common being the flare on the left combusts the landfill gas, and that's just the easiest. It helps capture large amounts of gas volume. However, there are alternatives that are exercised by some of our sources. For example, Cold Canyon Landfill is a perfect example of all the different ways you can utilize landfill gas. So once collected, Cold Canyon runs about 80 wells or so, and they're ever expanding. So as they expand, they'll install more wells. They'll send this gas to an engine, which is the other photo, which in turn generates power that goes to the grid. And then they also send gas offsite to Sentinel Peak Resources, who can use that gas to power their steam generators. So they're kind of an example of all the different ways that you can use the gas. And then they too have a flare, but that's just more backup in case the other paths fail. In addition, they also may have things that we need to permit anyway beyond their gas collection control systems. So landfills are a very highly regulated source. So one of the things I want to mention is that we're just one of the pieces of the pie, but they also have Department of Toxic Substances Control, the Water Board, CalRecycle, but they do have several tiers of air quality regulations that apply. At the federal level, we have the EPA. You may remember in June, we talked about the federal Part 70 permits program. That's also Title V permit program. Three of our five Title V permits are landfills. And those Title V permits help capture there's a few different regulations at the federal level alone that landfills can be subject to. So those permits help incorporate those different requirements. For a while there, until 2010, when the state implemented their own regulation, federal and local regulations were it for landfills. This Title V permit program and all the regulations it kind of captures have a lot of tracking and reporting to ensure those gas collection and control systems are properly operating. So, mentioning the state, in 2010, we signed a memorandum of understanding with CARB so that we could help implement their new regulation at the time, landfill methane regulation. So this helped kind of bridge the gap between the federal and local regulations and then also introduce some new requirements, including surface emissions monitoring, where they have folks who go out quarterly and sweep the landfill for emissions. This is pretty extensive and also has reporting requirements that are separate from the federal requirements and then also requires testing of the control devices. Lastly, we have our local rule, Rule 426, landfill gas emissions. This was established in 1995, so it's been around for a bit, but it did also require landfill gas collection systems. It required that they don't leak excessively, and it defines what a leak is, and then it also requires that they test their control devices. So all of these played into what was on the permits. So those three together make for a really fun and complicated permit. So with that, we do our best to help our facilities comply with them and streamline things, and they definitely utilize contractors as well to help them with that. So on top of our annual permit renewal inspections, where for pretty much any site we go out, we visit, we look at records, walk the site. With landfills, it's actually a little bit more detailed. We bring out what's called the TVA 2020, which is short for Toxic Vapor Analyzer 2020. As you see with that picture of Anna, we kind of channel our inner Ghostbuster and we go around and we sweep for landfill gas. So what we're doing there is we're verifying that they're complying with the leak requirements. We're looking for any that we may find. You can definitely sniff it sometimes. And then we're confirming that from the various reports that they have to do, that they actually repaired the leaks that they found. In addition, we're also, if they are testing a control device that year, we may come and witness that and make sure that's being properly tested. So when we're doing that monitoring, we come back, we are logging our data while we're in the field, and we come back and it looks a little bit like this. There is location data as well, but for the privacy of the landfill, I figured I'd crop that off. But it's showing us in real time what we're seeing when we're smelling for methane or detecting it. Using flame ionization detection, that's the mechanism that helps measure the methane. We get real-time readings in parts per million of the methane. And so we're looking for anything that's over 500 and is sustained because that's the leak requirement. So that's kind of the physical portion. Then there's the reporting. So between all those different regulations, there are three primary reporting periods throughout the year. There's two federal and then one state, and they're pretty detail intensive. So we take the time to look over those and make sure that they implement all the requirements that they are regulated to do so. And it really helps us give an overview of how the gas collection and control system is doing as a whole. And we can help see trends like, is there an area that is excessively leaky? Are we seeing well temperatures rise? And that can be concerning. So we want to make sure, you know, are we losing vacuum in an area? So that does give us kind of an overall pulse check on the landfill system. I will say that that's important because, as we've seen down in Southern California's Chiquita Canyon landfill, when you see those trends, you can start to understand, is there a reaction happening? And unfortunately with them, they had a subsurface reaction and it resulted in one of the most significant environmental issues in Southern California right now. Lots of odors, lots of landfill gas, lots of leachate, the liquid portion, which thankfully we don't have to deal with, but all very toxic. And so it's a big issue that we want to help avoid by looking at all these different reports. We're also looking at the results from their surface emissions monitoring. So we're kind of auditing the third parties that are helping them comply with the regulations. And with that, we're the main liaison between all of this that's going on with our facilities. We work with CAR, we work with EPA, but we're kind of the boots on the ground, first ones looking at these reports and helping, if there are any changes to regulations, helping our landfills understand them. So beyond that, there's more coming. So landfills are not quite done. In fact, in California, there are a lot of efforts to improve the regulatory oversight of them. A couple years ago, the CARB worked with NASA and the Jet Propulsion Lab to do these flyovers. So here's an example to see where they see plumes of methane. So they went, they found oil and gas areas, landfills, et cetera. And for example here, so we remember the leak definition is 500 ppm. Blue is 1,000, green is 2,000, yellow is 3,000, and then red is 400 or 4,000 or more ppm. So they're finding some pretty hot spots at landfills. They didn't go over our county last time, so I don't know if that's a dodged bullet or we did so great they didn't need a bus of data. But we anticipate they'll do other flyovers in the future, and so we want to ensure our landfills are being operated to the best of their ability. We actually also had CARB come out and conduct two unannounced inspections with our landfills, two of our three landfills, about 2 months ago, and they invited us to come along, and that's actually how they do all their inspections, is they just show up. So our landfills were very gracious and accepted us, and we walked throughout, but there is definitely a tangible effort with CARB staff to get folks back out there really involved in the landfill program. Part of that being the state regulation, the landfill methane regulation, is going to be changing. So over the last 3 years, there's been two workshops and one public meeting going over upcoming desired changes to the regulation, clarifications, because there are some odd spots or gray areas that they want to kind of improve. So the state is definitely moving further towards ensuring that landfills are regulated. And similarly, the federal government is also, the EPA is also sharpening their sword towards getting landfill compliance dialed in, and they've updated a few of their regulations. So it's only becoming ever more prevalent. And that's all I got for you. Any questions?
Any questions? I'll start down this way.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Hammond.
Appreciate the report. I'm wondering if I can get our pass rolls data
for our landfill.
Yeah.
That I can share with our managers at.
Yeah, all those reports are subject to the Public Information Act. They're all public information in general, so we can pass that along as well.
Okay, I'd like to get that from you. There's another question I had too, and it had to do with the greenhouse gas part of this. I know that our wells, we flare it, I think, right now, but mm-hmm. they're also talking about making a generator type mm-hmm. system. Are there grants and things like that from APCD to do that kind of work, or?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
But where there is a need, like Megan said, there's potential. There's always that potential with general funds, but as I understand it, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Does not mean that if it's not through us, it could be through some other entity.
Agency.
There are a lot of other grant efforts that kind of overlap with our agency. Like we're mentioning, like a lot of EV grants that aren't ours. That are out there. So I imagine in the same light, maybe with the California state being so concerned about methane that they would offer something, but I can't speak to that. It's not my forte, but as far as I know, there is not that, so.
Very good. And the last question is, how often does our agency go out to the landfills? In other words, is there a regular pattern of time? And,
yeah.
and what's the cost? And we obviously charge for these kinds of services.
So we go out annually. That's covered by their permit fees, the first visit. Any time that maybe there's some issue and we have to go out significantly more than that cost is covering, then we may charge for extra time. We don't typically charge for extra time, though, if we go out during source testing. So when they're actually testing the flare, for example, we go out and we witness that. That's not charged any extra time. That's just part of their service. Renewal fees as well. So it's very rare that we would do enough that we would trigger that additional cost that we're allowed to by Rule 302, Section F4, that kind of covers any additional time. But that's usually reserved for if someone's really not getting it, you have to go out and out and out and you're kind of going, redirecting your time from other sources. But we don't use that often. So this is all pretty much covered by their renewal fees.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Paulding.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the comprehensive presentation. If and when CARB comes, does an inspection and uses the aerial technology that you mentioned and it identifies a bunch of those hot spots, what happens next?
Well, they definitely let folks know. I think they let both the facilities and the districts know. Like, hey, we picked you up. So at that point, that would put, if someone was flagged in our district and it was a regulated source, you know, because sometimes it could be a gas pipe or something, it's something that we maybe wouldn't normally regulate. But if it is a regulated source, then we would work with them to ensure that if it, whatever leak it maybe gets fixed and put them on track with some type of timeline to fix it. Probably
okay.
through some type of enforcement action.
So we're invited to the inspection. If they generate findings, then we're responsible for enforcement.
Yeah, and the flyovers are a separate thing.
Okay.
When they came out, they also had the TVA 2020 with them. So we did a side-by-side sniff. And so if they found anything, we made sure that we could also replicate any of their findings, just in case their equipment was wonky or something, you know, if it was just a blip and it wasn't a sustained leak, then we would make sure that we could find that and log it accordingly. So, but we would follow up on how that goes enforcement action wise. They do reserve the right to do it, but they usually lean on us to do any enforcement.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the very interesting report. I'm curious if besides landfills, if we monitor methane and other greenhouse gas emissions from other sources. I know that the city of San Luis Obispo's wastewater treatment plant does generate methane, and then there's I don't know how it happens technologically, but the methane then is used as a source of energy that goes back into to supply energy for the operation of the wastewater treatment plant.
Yeah, that's correct.
And then the biodigester also generates methane, and I know they have a contract with PG&E.
Mm-hmm.
PG&E buys the methane and uses it, has like a pipe that they take it someplace where they can use it to generate electricity.
Yeah, a variety of our sources, especially ones with digested processes. So out by the airport, the CompoGas facility uses the digestion process to create energy and power their facility and send power back to PG&E. Yeah, wastewater treatment plants will utilize any methane that is emitted to typically, I mean, as a backup, they could flare it, but at our wastewater plant, for example, they do run a cogeneration engine. So there are some folks already kind of capturing their methane and using it for its purpose.
Yeah, but does the Air Pollution Control District also monitor other sources besides landfills?
Yes.
Yeah.
We have permits with those sources, and we actually have them do conduct testing to ensure that they're operating properly as well.
Good. Thank you very much. Yeah. Kate, do you have any questions down here? Mr. Eccles?
Thank you for your report. Appreciate it. So am I correct in understanding that we have three landfills in the district that you monitor?
Three active ones. Los Osos landfill is closed, and they are kind of in a pretty cool interim phase right now where they implemented a gas collection and control system to help with their groundwater issues. They have better groundwater control now, so they're looking to kind of get that gas collection control system out. We're working with them to implement some newer technology, actually. It's called a solar spark flare, basically something more passive because they generate such little gas and it has such low methane content, it's nearly not combustible, that we want to help them not operate such an expensive flare, but also ensure that if there are hiccups or increases in gas buildup, that we can still capture that. So Los Osos landfill is one of those where they're still in the state overview, but they're not a federally recognized source. And then there's some, I think it was Camp Slow historically, and then also Camp Roberts have had some landfills, but they were only construction materials and are eventually phased out by state and federal oversight.
Great, thank you. You anticipated my next question on that, so thank you for
perfect.
Clarifying on those others. My last question is are you aware of any high-risk incidents or occurrence that can happen at the three that would cause an incident, you know, a disaster? The only thing that comes to mind maybe is earthquake, but fire probably not. But what, in other words, what's the huge potential risk in terms of a severe incident at any of those landfills?
Yeah, well, one thing that we've been advised to do is ensure that we're looking at well temperatures, because as there may be some subsurface reaction like what happened down in Southern California, that reaction could generate heat. So that could be a good indicator, like, hey, look at me. As any infrastructure ever, they have a timeline on them. So if it is an older landfill, it could be that that infrastructure, you know, decays or something, and that could be a concern. So in Chiquita, for example, it was a very old closed section of the landfill that had the subsurface reaction. So that is something that folks with all the different monitoring that they do would have tabs on those trends. But we haven't seen any significant issues with our sources. I mean, there's always going to be little here and there things because they have so much that they have to take care of. It's not expected that anyone would be perfect, but we don't have any concerns that there is something more telling of any of our facilities. And even like with Chicago Grade, they noticed their gas was generating to the point where they were maxing out their current flare, and they had their flare replaced with a bigger one so that they could capture that gas and it wouldn't leak out any other direction that it saw fit, so.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how much gas do our landfills produce relative to other sources in the county?
A lot. I would, if I mean,
relative to, for instance, these chambers on a given Tuesday or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, I don't know. It's definitely multiple million cubic feet. I think definitely over 100 million cubic feet compared to, we're always in the double digits for even some of our larger natural gas sources that run boilers, things like that. So they're generating a lot. They're not also capturing everything. I mean, in a perfect system, you'd capture it all, but there is an expected loss that comes with potential leaks, things like that, just path of least resistance for the gas. So. But they anticipate anywhere between 70 and 90% collection. And with that, I think there was one that was about 150 million cubic feet, could be more.
Per year?
That is data that we collect, though, every year and quantify emissions from that. So.
And as you started to study engineering, did you imagine you'd be studying decomposing garbage?
Yes, because...
I love it.
Cal Poly, the environmental engineers, one of the big things they study is wastewater. So that was my first surprise, was studying that and all that goes into that, and the power that can be generated from it. So landfills were the next obvious course, you know, yeah.
Yeah. I have
any other questions?
Yeah, so I the diagram in there was interesting that showed the piping system that goes in. I know this, I remember learning about this probably 30 years ago when it first started coming about, and I thought it was interesting that they're collecting, figured out a way to collect the gas. My question is, this piping system that's collecting it and doing all the things that you're saying, how much is actually emitting out of the soil that's not being collected by that, that's just going to be naturally coming out? It would seem to me that there's got to be some.
Yeah, the goal would be none, but there is an assumed loss that they're not getting everything. That's why that quarterly monitoring is important. They're looking for a crack, a gopher hole, anything that has created a path that is not the landfill gas well. As we saw that flyover, that clearly had some gaps in collection, so there is always that potential. Like I mentioned, some folks assume kind of on the lower end, 70% collection, so that's 30% loss. On the higher end, they assume in the 90s, so smaller loss. It just kind of, and that's just an estimate from the facility, but we anticipate there is a good chunk that is still coming out.
Is that a product of the engineering on, you know, pipe placement and proper, I don't know that much about the systems, but
it could be just what people tossed. You know, we're diverting a lot of our organics out of landfills, or doing our best as a state to do so, and the organics do generate a lot more gas, but with that being a newer requirement, there may be some old organics that are creating a lot more gas. Older areas that just, or that need more cover, a rain event that may have disturbed what was once a nice intact system, or the opposite, drought events that are keeping it kind of starting to crack, create holes, but anything can happen on a landfill.
All right, thank you.
Just curious, since they generate so much gas, is it actually profitable in any way for the collection, I mean, to offset their expenses?
What do you mean by that?
For the landfill. So they obviously have an expense for doing the collection, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're generating power.
Generate power. Not all of them do. So we actually only have one that is currently generating power.
So it's an expense to them,
sure,
or to the ratepayers.
Yeah, and it would be also a public health expense to not, with even just a small crack. I mean, it's pretty gnarly. It's like passing the cow fields on the 5, you know, but it would be the entire landscape of the landfill, and there are a couple hundred acres at times, so it'd be something that either direction it would be an expense, maybe not financially paid by the landfill, but by the people around for their public health impacts, toxics, and the greenhouse gas impacts at large too.
You hit my next question.
Yeah.
When they do the flyovers, is it generally a flyover, if you know this, of just the landfills, or do they do like a region?
They did several regions, so they actually covered a good amount of ground on the state. It's public information too. So Methane Source Finder through CARB has that map that I got that screenshot from, and that's where they also went over oil and gas facilities. I mean, you name it, even like a SoCal gas pipeline or something could get caught in that. So anything and everything that, except for they didn't fly over our county, so we didn't get any data for that, but anything they flew over that showed anything over 1,000 ppm showed up on there.
Yeah, because you showed that chart, that I'll call it a heat map, right? I'm just curious how that would look overall if you were covering SLO County.
Yeah.
If we would see other producers
that
we wouldn't expect.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully we wouldn't see too much if they flew over our county. That means we're doing our job and so are our facilities, but I guess we'll have to see once they do that additional flyover. But yeah, if you want to look, it's a little harder when you're zoomed out on California, but you can zoom into other sources and look at different plumes and kind of what that looks like.
Okay. Yeah, here's a comment. One time I was shocked when I saw a heat map of methane over wetlands and actually seeing how much wetlands naturally produce something that you would think would be natural and wouldn't have a harmful effect, but
biological processes, baby.
That's
it happens. So, yep.
Thank you.
Thanks. Do we have any more questions? Or I'd just like to make a comment. Having served on the Integrated Waste Management Authority board for 10 years now, and just for all of us to encourage our constituents to use those green bins and go ahead and compost and keep the organic matter out of the landfill. That's something really concrete that we can do. We're actually mandated to do it, AB 1383. So thank you for your report. It's fantastic. So.
Yeah, no problem.
Good. Is there any public comment on the report? Good. Any further comments from the board? Okay. Well, now we're getting close to the end of our agenda today. Board member items. Do we have any board member items? Everyone is being very quiet. Okay. Alrighty, well, with that, unless there's anything else, I will adjourn this meeting at 10:36. Thank you.